Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, which happens to be my bookshop. So instead of listing all our social media like I used to, I just say Google us, because everything we do is there. Today, we are really pleased to have with us Lauren Acampora, who will be talking about her debut album, like you're a musician, her debut novel, The Wonder Garden, which was published in May of this year by Grove Atlantic. So Lauren's fiction has appeared in the Paris Review, the Antioch Review, and many other publications. She lives in Westchester with her husband, Thomas Doyle, who's a great artist. You can find him at thomasdoyle.net, and who designed the cover for this book, which perfectly meshes with the content of the book, and we can talk about why that's so. It's a cover that, yeah, fortuitously kind of actually mirrors the thematic elements of the novel. And as we were just talking about before we started, they seem to be a great pair both as collaborators and partners. So The Wonder Garden is a series of interlinked stories. At first I thought I was going to be reading a novel. So there's characters appearing and reappearing, allowing you to see different sides of them, obtaining a perspective that otherwise might be lost on the reader. I always like being in some place and then going someplace else and looking back at the place I'd been. It's a really good way of, I think, living your life. Lauren's work has been compared with that of Cheever, Beattie, and they just say hints of O'Connor, because I think if they said exactly like Flannery O'Connor, that might be over the top. So Lauren loves the visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, and as you remember, Jennifer was here to talk about that book just before she won the Pulitzer Prize back in 2011, and she was so cool. So anyway, as I was saying, these stories visit in miniature, like the cover, the inner struggles, ambitions, and weirdness of the inhabitants of Old Cranberry, Connecticut, which is a bedroom community in the book, of New York City. So in some ways, the stories touch the brains, literally and figuratively, of people whose lives are small and big, happy and sad, familiar and scary. And we see ourselves in these places, in these minds, for better or for worse. And the coolest thing is it all rings true, again, for better or worse. So welcome, Lauren. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm so excited about this.
That's great.
I'm glad that you mentioned Jennifer Egan. I just spent the morning listening to your interviews on the iTunes store with some of my very favorite writers, Jennifer Egan being one of them, A.M. Holmes, T.C. Boyle, George Saunders. It's like a who's who.
Oh, yeah, I know. I couldn't believe, I can't believe I get the people I get, including you. I mean, George Saunders and then Paul Harding for Tinkers. So I had like three of the last Pulitzer Prize winners and the last two National Book Awards, and I just spent the evening with T.C. Boyle after we talked on the radio, and it was so much fun. I took pictures with my daughter, and it's really great. I really love doing it. It's something that I don't take for granted.
Maybe it's not a coincidence that these authors all win big awards. Maybe they're some kind of a magic charm.
Well, I think a lot of it's due to my producer, Rebecca, who just has this kind of sixth sense about what's going to be big. And who knew that when she picked the Goon Squad that it was going to win the Pulitzer Prize?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but what a great book.
Oh, it was incredible.
Really one of my favorites.
She got mad at me because I said her title wasn't that good. And then
I laughed at that part.
Oh, yeah, right.
And she said, and I know how that feels, to be so attached to a title before you've even written anything for it. It's like, can I use this title now? Can I use it now? And titles are so hard for writers.
Well, the only reason I said it was because in the book, I was trying to joke, because in the book, one of the characters says, what do you mean by the Goon Squad?
Right.
And so I said, if the character doesn't know, never mind, she'll just get mad at me again. So, and plus we're here to sell your book, not hers.
Yeah, sure, sure. I know, it's hard.
So I know the first story, let's talk about this first. Your upbringing informed a good deal of this book, didn't it?
Yes, very much.
Why don't you tell our listeners about that, how that happened?
Sure. I grew up in a town in Connecticut called Darien, which is sort of well known for being a really picture-perfect, suburban town, really prosperous and well-maintained, and it's actually the inspiration for the Stepford Wives, which growing up there was not, you know, too far-fetched for me to imagine. And everyone's just very well turned out, and all the houses look beautiful, and it was a great place to grow up, absolutely fantastic. You know, my mother used to call the place La La Land. You know, also, she grew up in the Bronx, and, you know, said, honey, this is not how the real world is. I just want you to bear that in mind. When you get out of, when you leave this little, paradise, you're going to see. And, of course, she was right. So I fled as soon as I could. I went out into the world and lived in New York City for many years. And, but, you know, Darianne always kept a hold on me, just that experience and coming from that place. And when I came back to live in the suburbs to raise a family, this time I'm in Westchester County, which, you know, is in New York and really just over the border from where I grew up. Not that different, but when I came back as an adult and as a writer, I find this environment to be very rich for fiction writing. The people around me, my neighbors and the people that I've met, are all absolutely fascinating. Just, I mean, all people are, but there's something about the houses, I suppose, and towns like this. The houses are almost characters themselves, and just every house I pass, I wonder, who lives in there? What are they doing? Why does the house look that way? Do they renovate it? Why do they choose this particular color, those flower boxes, or that house there, the paint is peeling? What do the neighbors think of that person? What does that person think about, you know, how they appear to others? Do they care, or do they, you know, give the neighborhood the middle finger on purpose? You know, it's, these are the questions that come to mind as I'm driving around.
Yeah, and you even have one short story that essentially is about a house. It's essentially about the house itself and, you know, what's happening to it or what might happen to it, which
right,
is fascinating.
Right, the colonial era house in the story The Virginals, right?
Isn't right, yeah. That story was, so, you know, it's not like it's, I mean, it is, it's not meant to be a funny book, like, ha-ha, but, like, a couple things I laughed at were, how she loved her stays, you know, her corset stays.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, they just really, then that one, there's one line, one page where she's really happy that she has the stays, you know? And it's the same paragraph where she talks about how Mrs. Cook, right?
Comfort Cook.
Yeah, Comfort Cook, how she must have fed, you know, her kids, at least the three that survived.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me laugh out loud, too, whether you meant it or not. That was pretty funny.
No, I meant that to be funny, for sure. I mean, it is somewhat humorous. Some of the stories do have humor, for sure. But, you know, that story is about, as you were just describing, it's about people who live in a historic house, Revolutionary era, colonial era house, you know, one of the ones with the date plaques. That, you know, there are quite a few of them around here. And they are obsessed with the history of the house and the former occupants from colonial times that the house was named for, the cookhouse, and Comfort Cook, and I forgot the name of the husband, but, and the family, the mother and the father, they have two children. They bring them up in this colonial house and try to hew as closely as possible to how life may have been originally in that house. No electricity, no fancy renovations, certainly no swimming pool, no dryers, clothes, etc. And, yeah, Cheryl, the woman in the cookhouse, she dresses in these old-fashioned corsets underneath her clothes, and she feels as if they keep her integrity strong. They keep her true to this type of life. And there are people like this who really love that era, and they get together, and there's a subculture of people who love that time in American history. And, you know, it's sort of humorous to people who are outside of it, but it's also very lovely in a way, and that community is very strong, and the values that people are trying to uphold are worthy. So I like to imagine, what is it like to be in the head of someone like that and to live in a house like that and to do the very best you can? And what is it like to raise two children in modern society, trying to instill these sort of antediluvian values that, you know, people sort of scoff at now, and the struggles that someone like that would have.
Well, it's like in the title story in Wonder Garden, and it's really interesting the way lies work externally and internally in the Wonder Garden. But it's like Rosalie, you kind of, at first, you know, and you seem viscerally attached to it as well. You really despise her because she represents so much of what is wrong in America, and I won't get into the political aspect of it, but at the same time, and I don't even know why, there's something about her that it's not like you, and I don't mean it like pity or you feel sorry for her, but there's something about her that I don't want to say you like, but you know what I mean? It's
yeah,
like she's...
I would hope she's sympathetic in some way.
What way would that be?
Well, you tell me.
She,
like everyone else in the book and everyone I know, is just doing the best she can with the restrictions of her personality and her experience, her knowledge. What's interesting to me is how, as humans, we're all restricted in these ways. Our upbringing, we're like plants or flowers that have been trained in a certain direction, but all essentially the same down in the roots. I mean, it sounds a little new agey, but this is how she was brought up. This is what she's been exposed to. Her experience is not very expansive. She hasn't traveled really. She's only stayed in one part of the country, and she's a mom, and she's devoted, and maybe overly devoted, as some mothers can be. But she's trying in her way to be a great parent and to be a good citizen and do what she thinks seems right. Her intentions are all good, and that's what all of my characters have in common, is that their intentions are nothing but good. In their minds, sometimes their minds are a bit twisted.
Well, it's like she goes through this traumatic event that, and the way you end the story is like, mm-hmm. She's going to be the best Rosalie she can be, which is what we all should be in terms of how we should live. But at the end you say, because that's all she can do.
Yeah.
I mean, she has no choice. She has to be the best Rosalie she can be. Otherwise, she'll just disintegrate.
She was blindsided by the discoveries that she made in that story, and really unprepared for them psychologically,
right.
Emotionally.
And
what can you do? Either, yeah, as you say, disintegrate or just try to carry on.
And there's so much you can talk about, and that's what's the mark of a really good book, because, and especially when you do it in short stories, because usually it's done in a novel, and we can talk about how the first story could have been the novel and... Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself and behind myself. But the coolest thing is how there is another story where, again, that perspective I was talking about, you're sitting at one table and then you're sitting at another table. And that's what's so fascinating about. Did you, think when you were writing Rosalie, when you were writing The Wonder Garden, did you think that you would then later on be writing a story in which she was looking back at her? Did you know that was going to happen?
And who was looking back at her?
Which one? The blonde, attractive woman.
Oh, of course. Yes, yes. All right, right, right. No. A lot of these connections happened after the first drafts of the stories were written. And I started to make more and more connections as I was writing the stories and then going back and revising them so that they would fit in this sort of like a puzzle. And no, when I wrote the story of Camille, the story called Visa, when I first started writing that story, I wasn't even sure who the guy really was that she was seeing, that she was dating the surgeon. And I don't know, I don't want to give away anything.
No, that's why I'm better at not doing spoilers than you are.
All right, maybe I should hold my tongue. But to answer your question, no, I wasn't aware of it. At the beginning, but these connections organically presented themselves as I was putting the stories together in this linked way, and that was really fun.
I was just gonna say the exact same thing. It seems like it must have been really fun.
Oh yeah, and finally I had to make myself stop because I didn't want them to be too tightly connected or too implausibly connected. But there were little touches here and there that I added at the last minute. Like there's a dress that appears twice and you know, little sort of inside.
Stop giving away stuff.
Okay.
But what's funny is like, but you come through too. Like you must hate airports because in the Virginals and the Wonder Garden, you don't like airports. It doesn't seem like.
Oh, just JFK.
Yeah, you really hate it.
It's JFK. I mean, every time I arrive home from an international flight and get off the plane off this runway, JFK is the worst possible first face to present to people who are just arriving to the United States for the first time. It's like this is like the pit. So
I would opt for Philadelphia. Philadelphia.
Much nicer.
No, it sucks.
Oh.
No, I mean, I would opt for Philadelphia as the worst place to come into.
Okay, all right. That's good to know.
You know, I mean, when you get out of the airport even, if you're from Germany, you get out of the airport and you're looking for I-95. For 10 years, I-95 was painted in Krylon paint on a 4x8 sheet of plywood.
Wow. Yeah, I feel like I've seen that sign.
Probably.
Yeah, what a welcome.
Yeah, I know.
It can only get better from there, right?
So talk about how... the first story, Ground Fault, about the building inspector primarily. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? And then why did you abandon it as the beginning of a novel?
Oh, that's a very interesting twist on the question. Well, the first part I'll answer by saying that I bought a house. That's how it started.
I knew that.
Yeah. My husband and I moved up from the city, and we were house hunting up here in the suburbs, and you know, when you buy a house, you need to have a home inspection, and here comes this man and takes us around the house, and he's very, very knowledgeable, and just curiosity, what's it like to be a home inspector, and what do you see? Because a home inspector gets to go into a lot of the different houses, which isn't a dream job in a way for me. My fantasy is to go into all of these houses.
Oh, yeah.
What. So what would it be like for someone like that? And, you know, what thoughts or emotions might he be keeping inside when he meets a new family, and what if he was having troubles of his own domestically and encountered this very optimistic, sunny, new, pregnant couple moving up with all the hopes in the world, and he's just had terrible destruction in his own marriage. So that's where that came from. Has nothing to do with the actual home inspector that we used. I don't know anything about him, but I imagine things. And the novel question, strangely enough, this book came out of a different story. It was called The Umbrella Bird.
Yes.
About the couple that moves up from New York City, and the husband experiences a kind of mystical calling while building a treehouse in the woods for their unborn child, and he drops his career as an advertising executive sort of without consulting with his wife, pregnant wife, and goes off into a new age direction and decides that this will be his new career. That was a novel. I wrote the whole thing.
Oh.
And it was not very good, I didn't think. So rather than, I had invested so much time in writing it, and the characters still were very interesting to me, but the scaffold of the novel was Madeline's point of view, the wife's point of view, and to me it wasn't strong enough to support the whole novel, and I finally had to just admit that it wasn't working and salvage anything I could, which was a short story, which is called The Umbrella Bird in this book. So then I had the bright idea, while reading Jennifer Egan's book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, and Olive Kitteridge and Colin McCann's Let the Great World Pass, those three fabulous examples of linked short story collections that are essentially novels, I had the bright idea that, hey, wait a minute, these books are fantastic, and wouldn't this be fun? I think I'll give stories to the other ancillary characters that had been in the novel and see what their lives are about, and the next thing you knew, I was creating this book. And that's when it came alive. The novel had felt like work when I was writing it, and this didn't.
In my fantasy, the couple was you and Thomas.
Well, one of my favorite questions as a writer is the question, what if? What if? You know, what if a marriage was tested this way? What if Thomas decided, rather than just, you know, I mean, in a way, maybe this is a metaphor now that I think about it, because Thomas was actually in advertising. And he is also a visual artist, as we know. And what if he had just completely dropped his career and had no paycheck and just went for it with the art career and we were starving? And I don't know. That's one thing. Or what if something similar happened to another couple and I just took it to an extreme? And that's where the Umbrella Bird story came from. It also came from an acquaintance of mine whose father did a very similar thing. He had been working, I guess, in a corporate job and just felt called into a different type of life. And he went to Mongolia to study with a shaman there. She went with him. And that story has always stayed with me, so...
Yeah, it's funny. One of the reasons I don't think, I mean, I can write exposition and I can write narrative, but I can't think of stories. And one of the reasons I think I can't is because I always forget that writers can lie. You're allowed to lie about everything.
You have to. You're supposed to.
Yeah. And I always forget, oh, yeah, I can. That doesn't have to be true. It's like I always think about stand-up comedians. They do the same show every night, and it would be really hard for me to do that because it's like, hey, I'm telling the same thing exactly that I did before. That's kind of unfair, isn't it?
Yeah, that's cheating.
Yeah, but it's not. It's what you do.
Yeah.
And what's really funny about Groundfault is my family has been building houses since 1958, so we're intimately familiar with house inspectors. And it's really interesting because some of them are almost angelic and some of them are almost devilish. And this guy, without giving anything away, he has an agenda, and he's willing and able to play with people's minds and send them in a different direction, and whether it's the realtor or the buyers. Because when he walks through it, it's not necessarily what he presents as his conclusions. And I've seen that happen over and over and over again.
Have you really?
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. Because it can kill a deal. He can kill a deal if he wants to. Mm-hmm. Or he can make it, you know... Yeah, this is a great house. Go for it.
Yeah, and the realtor depends on the inspector.
And you know a lot about it, too, because it's always like, yeah, here's my conclusions. In a couple of days, you'll get my written report. Always that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was interesting for me.
Well, that is very interesting to hear that there are inspectors that do those sorts of things.
What happened when Rosalie, and the really good part was when Rosalie... No, it's a spoiler. I'm not going to say it.
Oh, okay.
Well, she reaches this literal and figurative breaking point. Mm-hmm. And that was like a really pivotal part of the book for me and, you know, the way I perceived her is that she almost succumbs to something but then pulls back. But
right.
Anyway, so the Afterglow, this guy Harold, and you can talk about him, but before you talk about him, I just wanted to say, I feel like he's the worst of American capitalism, but the best of American curiosity.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really great way of thinking about him. Yeah. So, yeah. He has a sense of entitlement to, you know, that no one else can really match. A fabulously wealthy, or you know, or. So rich beyond measure, businessman, CEO of sort of a hedge fund, and ensconced in his mansion on the Long Island Sound, and but always reading science magazines because he'd always been interested in science as a boy, and this is the path that he didn't take. And in a way, that comes from me because neuroscience is something that's always interested me. If I could do it all over again, I might go in that direction.
Me too.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah,
always.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And especially now. I mean, every day I look in the news and I see these advances and I can't... It's science fiction. It's crazy what they're determining the brain is about and what... Anyway, I could go on and on. So Harold has a similar fascination with brain science. And as it happens, his wife is diagnosed with... a brain tumor that is causing her to have epileptic episodes and needs to go in for surgery. And Harold takes advantage of this situation, and that's all I will say.
I like the way, since you are talking about money, I like the way the one person says, you know, cash, of course. Yeah, when they're sitting at the restaurant or whatever he's talking about.
Yeah, he can pay with cash. He can bring you a suitcase of it.
And then he pats his pocket. It's just so American. But then at the same time, like I said, he's, without again giving anything away, it's just like that one moment using his finger, he mm-hmm. changes his entire relationship with his wife, and it becomes such a more intimate one. It's not necessarily the way you would go about it in real life, mm-hmm. but he finds that, you know, because Carol is nice, and it's always nice when a couple who've been married for a long time go back to the beginning of their relationship, whether it's in Spain or the Amalfi Coast, and the wife is wearing a peasant skirt and they can't wait to get back to the bedroom. It's always lovely to imagine that, and he gets to the point where it's almost like he feels that way about her again.
Yeah, he feels closer to her afterward. It's a deviant act, what he does.
Yeah.
He crosses a boundary that's really shocking, and without her knowledge, and yet he feels closer to her.
Yes.
Afterward, and so it's ambiguous whether the act was positive or negative. It depends on, you know, whose perspective you take.
I like the way the nurses look at him and they go, Polish?
Yeah, right. He's masquerading as a Polish surgeon. Right. Polish, really?
And then the way the doctor gives him like a knowing look. Uh-huh. And then he just steps out. But it's fine. He can step out then.
Yeah.
You're good about like, because this is like, I remember this moment so perfectly. In Paris, in that room with the white bedspread mm-hmm. and this big window and Paris noises and the sunlight and the curtains billowing inward. There's something about that. That was a perfect moment. It was like a deal with the devil. And I was thinking, okay, if you ever had to stop everything and this is the moment you'll live forever, mm-hmm. that was the moment.
That's it. Well, I just got a chill. Yeah, no, I can picture the room so vividly.
Yeah, I mean, there's a book out now called What Do We See When We Read? And it's like, when you think of Anna Karenina or Dagny Taggart or some Olive Kitteridge, what do you see? Do you see who this person looks like? Do you really see their face? Do you see the house in the fall, the house of Usher? And you don't really see it. You see something. But with regard to your room in Paris, I saw the exact room. And that's pretty good that you did that.
I'm so curious if your room looks like my room. In my head, I bet it looks very similar.
Oh, it has to. It
yeah,
has to.
Yeah. it's like what do you call when you can, ESP. You
know? No, it's channeling.
Writing is like that in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. That's exactly, and that's why people come into the bookstore and they don't want to use their Kindle. They want to hold the book. And they think, and they're right, they're holding the author in their hand. Mm-hmm. And it makes a big difference. And
Yeah. I have never tried reading on a Kindle.
And I have to because this is an occupational hazard. I can't come in here to the radio station with books and books and books. So I have a little tiny device that'll hold 100,000 of them. And I can take notes on your book in it. But at the same point, geez, I'm destroying my bookstore now. Shoot.
Yeah, wait a minute.
All right, let's skip that.
But as you say, back to holding the author in your hand, only a physical book really can you have that feeling with. So, but yeah, that's so interesting, though, about what you see when you read. And you know, as you were just listing the books, the titles, Anna Karenina and all of those, I thought of The Great Gatsby just now in a similar room with the curtains billowing in.
Oh, and the shirts, and the shirts.
Oh, and the shirts, of course.
Yeah, that I can see, but I think maybe I see that because of the two movies. I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it's my memory or just the memory of the movies. But I know when I was a kid, I knew what it looked like. But going back to, let me see. I wanted to go back to Camille. No, Rosalie. No, wait a minute. Camille. When you say her face round and overfed like a pink All-American sow, it's like you really believe that. I mean, you really meant that as something. Is there a part of you that has, like, I have that part that really kind of, what the heck is this? You know, what kind of country is this? Is there like a part of that, without you going too far out on a limb here, because you got to sell your books?
I try to grab these thoughts that flit through my head that are really terrible. And I think we all have them, but usually as civilized people, we tamp them down and try not to give them too much rein. And you see somebody out and you think, whatever ungenerous thing you might think about them at first glance, and you think, oh, I shouldn't be thinking that's terrible. This is a human being with, lots of, with their own, I think there's even a line in the book, there was a character scolding himself. This is a human being with their own generosities and heartaches. Be nice in your thoughts, and even in your head, trying to keep your thoughts generous. But I like to grab those bad ones, the judgmental ones, when they come up in my brain, and take them out and really examine them, and then that's where I find my characters. I put them into a character. I put that thought. Look at that person overfed like a American sow or whatever that thought was, and what if somebody really felt that way?
Well, it's like a good example is like if you went into Walmart, which I will never voluntarily do in my life, but if you do and you see some, overweight woman berating her child for doing nothing wrong and saying, I'm going to hit, if you do that one more time, I'm going to slap you. And you want to go up and say, no, this child is not being bad. This child is being good, but what you're doing to him is wrong. And you want to do it and you can't do it. But you have all those thoughts, and then maybe the cashier agrees with you as you're checking out.
Right, right. It's interesting. You should mention that particular scenario, because that exact scenario is where I came up with the idea for Sentry.
Oh.
Which is the story about the neighbor, the woman, older woman who's been in town for a long time, and she sees the little girl next door left alone in the yard. The babysitter has gone off and left a note, and the child is totally unsupervised at 4 years old. And she has been watching these next door neighbors that are relatively new to town, and she has that feeling. Like this mother, who is now a single mother, is not doing a good job parenting, is what she thinks. And how many times, just like you, have I had thought when I've seen somebody doing what I think is a crummy job parenting, and that thought is, I could do a better job, that child should come with me. And I'll be a better parent to her or him. And what if someone crossed the line? What if somebody took that thought and acted on it?
And then you have the other person, like Camille, who when she takes a ride says, okay, these people think you have to leave, stay with your child every minute. What's the big deal? You just drive across town, child's there, sleeping.
Yeah, right. It's 10 minutes. What's going to happen to your kid asleep in the bed if you leave your house for 10 minutes, is her thought.
Right, and those are the stories you read in the newspaper.
Yep, exactly. And then you have the person next door knowing exactly what's wrong with that, and that's why it's time for that child to come to her house. Stay there for a while.
So moving on, Swarm is just like really weird. Swarm is weird. And I don't know how Philomena and her husband can build that many insects that quickly. That's a lot of bugs.
It's a lot of bugs. Yeah, they work pretty hard.
And then poor Philomena, I really liked her.
I know.
And my father died of sudden cardiac arrest. And what happened was, he stood up between Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, and he said, I feel dizzy. And that was it.
Oh, my.
I know. It's 21 years ago. But
still. Yeah.
The idea is like, you have this expression on her face that is not one of pain. It's just one of like, hey, this is happening. And then it just happens.
Yeah.
So if you think of death and how you want to die, that's not the worst way to die. Yeah.
But I had a hard time with that moment because I love my characters and I don't like to say goodbye to them. And I always sort of hesitate before having a character die. But, you know, many, many books have characters die in them. Many of the best ones, of course, have death as part of them. But Swarm is a story, yeah, Martin and Philomena are this couple. They've been living in town for many, many years, and their real estate, the real estate in their neighborhood has skyrocketed. And with that, there is a new house that's just been built on the corner of their street, very ostentatious and really not in keeping with the look of the neighborhood as it has always been. And of course, they rush to judge these new neighbors. Oh, how could these people have no taste? Look at this ostentation. Who do they think they are? Of course, they end up meeting the neighbors and quickly changing their minds because the new neighbors turn out to be art collectors, and Martin is himself an artist who has not been very productive in recent years. But long story short, the new neighbors commission him to create the artwork of his dreams, an installation on their house, which is composed of all of these little foam insects that he affixes to the front, the facade of the house, so that it looks like a swarm of insects has overtaken this enormous house. So, you know, what cool neighbors after all to, you know, want to do something like this that's so unconventional. And in the production of the installation, Philomena has her episode and dies doing this project with her husband and trying to support him.
What's funny in that story, well, lots of things, but it's funny how you are able to pull off the idea that their family becomes secondary to the task, even for Philomena. And it just seems like kind of natural, but then when you step back, again, using your own sense of perspective, you go, wait a minute, that's pretty strange that they would, you know, ignore a holiday or the chance to see, you know, their family.
Yeah, yeah.
That you get so involved in it.
Yeah, and for Martin, he really thinks of it as this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that he never expected he would get at this late stage in the game. And his imagination kind of gets a little carried away, thinking of all of the press he might get and how this could be the renaissance for his career. Maybe this will be the moment. After a declining art career, he'll, you know, come racing back out and be on the cover of Art News.
Yeah.
And it really takes precedence. He becomes pretty obsessed with it. And that's the tragedy of the story is the loss that he has to confront while doing it. So, yeah, a lot of the stories are about vanity.
Well, you know, it's the other thing I think, sometimes I think you do come through and I figure you must not like local government because in the Virginals and the Swarm and Rosalie's presentation as the newest school board member, I mean, everything is all screwed up.
She hates fat people in government.
But I mean, I practiced law for like 30 years and representing homeowners associations and going before planning boards and stuff like that. It would just drive me crazy because there's always one person, and one of your characters reappears there.
Yeah.
There's just one person who messes everything up, who spends a lot of time talking, and that lady in the front row with the steely hair and all that. I mean, there's always one person who comes there every time for that particular reason.
It's so true. My mother just told me she went to, I don't know if she's going to be listening to this, but she told me she went to her town board meeting last week, and she was the one standing up, giving them a piece of her mind about the taxes and all of that, and she finally got so frustrated she walked out. So it's true. It really is.
Yeah, people.
I don't hate government at all. It's just that it's just rich for this sort, for these scenes. School board meeting is a fantastic setting for a scene, for a fictional scene. I had never actually been to a school board meeting, but I went to one so that I was able to better write that scene, and I'm glad I did.
Hey, did you ever see the movie Donnie Darko by any chance?
Oh, of course. I love it.
Okay, me too. So, I'm glad you saw it, because in Donnie Darko, remember that woman who, she was always trying to enlist help in, you know, doing her, the cheerleader, whatever, the sparkle people, like little kids.
Oh, right, right.
She reminds me a lot of Rosalie.
Oh, interesting.
And then she also, you know, she was so loyal to Patrick Swayze, even then when she finally realized. Doesn't she remind you a lot of her?
She does. It's funny. Now that you mention it, I wonder if on some level I may have been influenced by that character when writing Rosalie. I wouldn't be surprised because that movie had a big impact on me. I only saw it once, but I loved it.
You should watch it again. Because
I would like to, yeah.
Because all the Gyllenhaal people are in it who weren't popular then.
That's right. That was their debut, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's directed by Drew Barrymore, or produced by Drew Barrymore, too.
Oh,
and Noah Wiley was in that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, and the soundtrack is the soundtrack of my youth.
Oh, that song. What's the song?
The Killing Moon? Oh, no, Mad World.
Mad World, which I,
right.
Which I tried to sing at my open mic at my bookstore, which was a horrible disaster.
Oh.
It's a hard song to sing.
Yeah, it's complicated. It doesn't sound like it is, but it is. But, wow, okay. Yeah, Rosalie, I think, may have had some roots in that movie now that you mention it.
Do you think you'll keep, well, it's hard to keep doing this. It's not a novelist or a short story writer doesn't keep doing this over and over again because it's really hard to pull off and it's probably not what you always want to do. Are you working on a novel now? Are you working on more short stories?
You know, I always have short story ideas. There's a lineup of them waiting their turn to be written and I just get to them when I can. But I had written a novel before this project and also before that Umbrella Bird one. Which I had in a drawer for a while, and I knew it needed work, but I wasn't sure what. And after finishing this book, I brought that one back out after a few years, and I revised it substantially. And that's my next book, I think. Yeah, that's on deck. And that one also takes place in the suburbs, but it is a novel.
I always wonder when authors say they put it in a drawer for a while, or they worked for 8 years on this book or something like that, because I wonder, what do you do when you're not writing?
When I'm not writing?
Yeah, what do you do?
Oh, well, when I'm not writing that book, when that one was in the drawer, I was writing The Wonder Garden.
No, I mean, when you're not writing anything, what's your day like?
It's terrible. I'm not writing. well, you know, it's funny, most days... There are plenty of days. I should take that back. It's not terrible. There are usually things that I'm doing that are enjoyable in other ways, like spending time with my daughter or, you know, whatever it is that's keeping me away from writing. It's not always bad. But, and in fact, when writing The Wonder Garden, I spent many days not writing because I had a young child. I had a baby and then, you know, a preschooler who was not in school every day, and so I only could write when she was. But, so yeah, the answer to your question is I'm playing dolls. I'm, you know, doing housework, things like that, or job work, which was also the case for, you know, most of the time. And but yeah, that's so. When you say that people take 8 years to write a book, you're wondering if they, you know, that maybe they can't be writing every day. Is that what you mean?
Well, I don't know, because like I talked to Nell Zink, who wrote this book, Wall Creeper. And she has a new one coming out called Mislaid. And Jonathan Franzen kind of discovered her, but she's really whacked, and she wouldn't mind me saying that. Mm-hmm. But I said, so how long did it take you to write this novel? She goes, I don't know, about 6 weeks. I was like...
Oh, all compressed together, maybe.
Yeah, no, she just said she just cranked it out in 6 weeks. And it's like, but everyone else tells me it took years and years and years, and she just didn't understand that. And I guess it's just different people. I don't know. I've never seen rhyme nor reason to it.
Yeah.
It's like Neil Gaiman. I just was talking to him, and he just came out with a new collection of short stories called Trigger Points. It's about, the stories are all about things you shouldn't be reading because they're going to scare the hell out of you.
Mm-hmm.
Like a Ray Bradbury kind of thing, who's his idol anyway. But he just writes story after, he writes them with a fountain pen. He loves fountain pens.
Their rituals and the pace that they are comfortable at writing that at. And I mean, the thing that's so great about books is that some of them are tight and short, and you can tell that it was probably written quickly, but it doesn't make it any worse than the book that, you know, took a decade. And, but of course, one of my favorite contemporary writers is Donna Tartt, and she, as we know, takes a full decade to write these novels, and man, you can tell, because every single word has been thought through, and you can tell that this is written just slowly and carefully, and every sentence is carved so beautifully. So, of course, you know, I don't write that slowly, at least I, maybe I should.
That's funny, because there was a time in my bookstore when everybody was reading either The Goldfinch, Luminaries, or The Invention of Wings.
Wow.
But they would only pick one of them.
Well, sure. It takes, you know, a year to read it. It took me months to read The Goldfinch because I had to read every sentence three times.
Yeah, and then I interviewed Sumon Kidd on The Invention of Wings, and that was really interesting. But then The Goldfinch, you know, the cool thing about, we have two book clubs, and then there's lots of other ones that sit in there, but it's interesting watching the book clubs, because especially since I did it with you, they're all going to, you know, they'll be crawling across the table fighting with each other about whether this guy was a louse or whether he wasn't a louse or whether she had redeeming qualities or not, or, you know, how could you think that, you know? They do that until they start, well, like in your book, until they start gossiping and drinking. You even talk about it.
That's what book clubs ultimately are all about, right? So, oh, I'm so glad that this book will be the subject of discussion. I like to think that it would be good for book groups for that reason. There are a lot of...
Oh, yeah. That's what I meant.
Points. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then you can always, like we have a lot of time, authors Skype in, and then that's a lot of fun, because you're just like, it's almost like you're sitting at the table.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'd be up for that if you ever...
Yeah, definitely. If we pick one and pick it, and I think we should, because, you know, short stories get a bad rap, you know?
Yeah, no, I know. The linked ones, I think, especially, they could be sold. I mean, sometimes they are sold as novels and could be read as a novel. This one, I don't know. Some people think so, some people don't. But I like to think that there's more connective tissue to keep a reader, you know, keep a reader's momentum going throughout.
Yeah, I think what you've done is kind of like a public service, because you're, you know, taking the short story and taking it from being an orphan to being almost adopted, like some of your characters, because of the linking. The linking allows people to think, oh yeah, these people, oh, I remember them.
Right.
Yeah. You know what's funny too in the book is, like, every once in a while you'd read a person's name and you'll go, huh, I know that person. And then you have to go back, and it's kind of a pain, you know? You have to go back, and you go, oh, there she is. And that's also really cool, too.
Good, yeah. I hoped that readers would have that experience. And the beauty of connecting them in the way I did after having written the stories was that I was able to go back into some of the earlier stories and plant little treasures and seeds and things, you know, little breadcrumbs for people to follow back, and for people who really were paying attention or people who cared enough to go back and make connections that were not immediately evident.
Yeah, you're lucky, you know what's going on.
Yeah.
It's like the champion marathon runners, the guys who run it in like 2 hours and 7 minutes, they go, you know, it's easy for us. We feel like the guys who are out there taking 5 hours, it must be really, really hard for them, you know? It's like the writer kind of has it easy because he knows what's going on. And then the reader, well, like, did you feel like when you got published it, you were kind of letting your son go out into the world and you no longer had any, you know what I mean? Did you feel like you were letting go of something?
When the book arrived in my friend's hands, they were sending me little photos of the book, you know, coming out of the package or on their doorstep, and my response was, I feel like, you know, who let that out of the house? It's like my pet had escaped. So like, you know, somebody please return him to me. I should have put a little tag on it so that they could, you know, bring it back. But yes, it felt very much like a pet or a child.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
It was like my mother putting, you know, using Sharpie to put my name on my underpants when I went to overnight camp. Well, I don't mean, like, that sounded horrible. I don't mean it that way.
one of the funnier comparisons I've heard.
No, I take it back. That was horrible.
Your book is like a pair of underpants. So, I'm going to put my name on the insides of all of the books. Please return to, as found, reward. I'm getting used to it now, and it's great fun. It's so much fun to talk about the book. And this is my first book publication, and up until this point, I never talk about my books. I mean, I'm talking about everything else with my friends, and I know very, very few writers where I live now. It's not that kind of a place. It's not like living in New York where every other person is a writer. And so most of my friends and neighbors didn't even realize I wrote fiction until the book came out, and I just had a launch here at the Katona Library last week.
Yeah, I saw your tour, what your tour is coming up. You should come further south and come to Philadelphia.
Yeah, I would love that. I would. So, yeah, I'll talk to Grove about that. But, I came out to the Katona Library, and all the friends and neighbors were there, and
That's nice.
Sort of stunned. But it was nice to be able to talk to the book to them and talk about the book. Because, writing is a lonely occupation. You're in this room staring at a screen or at a piece of paper and in your own head for such a long time. And the publication is terrifying, but also just a real kick.
Yeah, it's funny. Every author I've interviewed, we had Christina Baker Klein, the author of Orphan Train, at our bookstore signing, and there was like 130 people, and we had to cut it off because I didn't have room for more people. And, her last novel before Orphan Train sold 10,000 copies, and this one sold 1.5 million in paperback, and it sold so many that they reissued it as a hardback, which is kind of really unusual.
I've never heard of that happening.
She hasn't either. And And the funny thing is that she's throwing names around of all these authors now, and it's like, you will now become a member of a club. It's like when they have the 7-time hosts of Saturday Night Live all getting back together again. You'll find, because it just came out, your book just came out, so now that when it's going to get really popular, which it will, you're going to know everybody all of a sudden. You'll be hanging out with Jonathan Franzen and, Paul Harding,
right.
All those guys.
Yeah, I hope so. That would be good. I went to a publishing party last night, and it was like that. It was like I had gone to some strange heaven where, all the name tags said things like Colin McCann and Phil Cly and all these folks, and I was just running over to them.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. So I hope there's more like that to come.
Yeah, there will be. And Phil Cly, I interviewed him too.
I have to listen to that. Yeah.
That's nice that you're listening to them. I never think anyone listens to them.
I love them. They're great. They are really fun interviews, and you're a good interviewer. I think that I can attest now to the fact that you make people feel comfortable.
I think the most important thing about being a good interview with regard to books is reading the book.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go on Good Morning America, granted they don't have time, but they're not going to have read the book. They're going to say, so what's your book about?
Right. It's soundbite.
Yeah, and the other thing that's important is asking questions that nobody else asks, that Mary Gross doesn't ask. Terry Gross.
Right.
Which is easy to do.
Yeah, that's true. No, and you do.
Well, thanks.
So, tonight I have a reading at Derry Ann Library, and that'll be fun.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That ought to be interesting.
Very strange. That will be surreal.
Yeah, that you could almost write a book about that.
I know.
Well...
Wow. Hoping that the people there will enjoy reading about people like themselves.
Well, no, some of them won't.
Yeah, maybe not.
The ones who are like Thurston Howell III will not.
Or they will. I don't know.
You might be right.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've talked for 53 minutes and 44 seconds, which is good.
That's fantastic. All right. I've had a great time.
Me too. It's a pleasure meeting you and talking to you. And like I said, if you ever get down this way or if the book club meets talking about your book, I'll give you a call, give your publicist a call, and we can work something out.
Please do.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Sam.
Have a great summer, and hopefully we'll talk again.
You too. Okay.
We were talking with Lara Acampora, author of The Wonder Garden, published just last month by Grove Atlantic. And the cool thing is, we were talking about, short stories get short thrift, which is hard to say 5 times fast. And what's cool about this is she's bringing the short story back into mainstream reading by linking the tales together in such an ingenious way that you feel compelled not only to read each story, but to, it's almost like a guessing game. It's almost like a mystery to go back and think, oh, yeah, that person was there too. And now I see that person's side of the story because I can see that person's side of the story. And that's really interesting and entertaining and illuminating. So I felt that the book was kind of one of a kind. And it does compare to some of the authors that have been suggested in other reviews, like John Cheever or Flannery O'Connor. And I can think of others, too. But in any event, she was a pleasure. Lauren was a pleasure to talk with. And it's so much fun when you get authors like that because, you know, it's just a conversation. And the fact that she was excited being here is like, why would you be excited to talk to me? But in any event, thanks again, as always, for joining us here today on The Avid Reader. I think next week we got a lot of good people lined up, really a lot of good people. Rebecca is doing a great job, always does a great job. Anyway, so next week we're talking to James Hanahan about his groundbreaking new novel, and it really is. It's called Delicious Foods. I'll talk about the title because people, I'm going to tell him, are thinking this is a cookbook, which he's going to get all the time, and it's not a cookbook. It's this dark, foreboding novel that is fascinating. And so, yeah, we will talk about that. And as always, so I have this new intro that you might have heard on this particular show, which I really like. And because the last one, when everyone was saying, was like a soap opera song. And this is the Dandy Warhol's Bohemian Like You, which is one of my favorite songs. And it kind of is more upbeat, so you feel like you're actually listening to a real radio show with a cool guy on it, notwithstanding. So in any event, as I said, as always, thanks so much for listening to us today. And join us next week when we talk to James Hanahan about his new book, Delicious Foods.